We are back this afternoon and ready to start our CLL and lymphoma discussion. We are very fortunate to have Dr. Danielle Brander, who is joining us from Duke, along with Dr. Moskowitz, who is joining us from the University of Miami. I believe that we have Dr. Love as well.
So really looking forward to this afternoon. In a second, we'll let Danielle get started talking about CLL. Really interesting that the next generation BTK inhibitor pirtobrutinib just got approved, although it was approved in mantle cell, but we'll talk a little bit about, as part of our discussion here, how that might fit in the future for CLL, as well as zanubrutinib, where we saw some really interesting data at the ASH meeting. So Danielle, maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the clinical questions we asked you to address in your chalk talks.
So in the time we have together, we'll start out talking about how to choose between frontline regimens of venetoclax or obinutuzumab versus a BTK inhibitor for patients who are needing treatment for the first time. And then moving into when we do choose a BTK inhibitor, which do we prefer and why, and is it ever appropriate to combine them? So just a couple points to we'll be able to expand upon later. Just remembering in the frontline setting that there's currently no resulted head-to-head trial saying ven, obin versus BTK inhibitor continuously, that one is superior over the other. Both can have high efficacy rates and their own risks and side effects. And so when I meet with patients in general, some of the things we'll expand upon is how do we look at three key things to make this decision? Patient-specific factors, that includes their concurrent medications or other comorbidities. What disease-specific factors? For example, you'll hear a lot across lymphoma about TP53 aberrations, such as TP53 mutation or 17P, and that sometimes can factor in, or how their disease presents. BTK inhibitors tend to be very good for lymph nodes reduction, venetoclax with higher MRD rates in the marrow. And then, of course, regimen-specific factors. The BTK inhibitors so far generally as monotherapy or with anti-CD20 are given continuously versus the fixed duration of the ven. And then there's a lot of unknowns that I think over time we're going to start to see emerge, including how best to sequence these agents, what you do when patients relapse, how to monitor them, and unknowns such as the cost. And lastly, I think all of us can agree that clinical trials really still play an important role in making these decisions. And when opting for a BTK inhibitor, just as a reminder for those, now that we have certainly more than one agent available, we have the covalent or the irreversible inhibitors, the first generation being ibrutinib. And now for patients newly starting, largely we favor acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib as second generation BTK. And that's because of two large randomized studies in the relapse setting showing similar efficacy but improved safety profile and less discontinuations. And then as Dr. Love alluded to, there are non-covalent or reversible BTK inhibitors, and just recently approved for mantle cell is pirtobrutinib, or formerly LOXO-305. And I think for many of us, the promising point here is that even for patients with BTK inhibitor resistance, these agents can be very active. We'll talk some about the toxicities of special interest. I think if you have a patient with any of these for BTK inhibitors, for example, bleeding, cardiovascular risk, hypertension, it's not just about choosing the newer generation, but how to prepare patients and manage that moving forward. And then lastly, just want to say not only were the head-to-head studies showing different in efficacy, but there have been two studies where patients with ibrutinib intolerance went on to tolerate acalabrutinib, and similarly in other BTK treatment with zanubrutinib, where patients with B-cell malignancies went from ibrutinib or acala intolerance onward. And then the, I think, last part that we have here before we go on to the discussion is just knowing about the combination. We won't have a chance to go through these, but ibrutinib and venetoclax combined can increase efficacy, their fixed duration. They can also lower the tumor lysis risk by leading in with the ibrutinib, and that's been looked at in phase 2 and phase 3 studies. And important questions here, though, I think, is what patients benefit from getting the combination versus monotherapy. So for the second chalk talk part before we answer question is how to envision pirtobrutinib and CAR-T with CLL. I already mentioned pirtobrutinib, or formerly LOXO-305, approved in mantle cell lymphoma. There was recently presented at ASH, though, a population of patients that I think, and this is how I'll end for unmet need in CLL, which are those that have had BTK and venetoclax, especially this area of unmet need, and pirtobrutinib has demonstrated efficacy there. Similarly, I think for CAR-T therapy, there is not yet, of course, a CAR-T product approved yet for CLL, but in clinical trials, again, if you look at this special subset of patients with both refractory or exposed to BTK and venetoclax, some of the response rates, those small number of patients, approach 50% in long-term remission. And outside of this in trials for these agents, I think we might start to see, for example, pirtobrutinib move to earlier lines of therapy because of the safety, but certainly we have these areas of unmet need for patients. And this also, just summarizing this, and beyond the scope of this talk, but I think for any of us having patients with Richter's transformation, we certainly know that's a great area of unmet need. And the studies looking at CAR-T or BiTE antibodies or other combinations are desperately needed for these patients.
So maybe we can chat a little bit about some of the points that Danielle brought up. Craig, can we maybe kind of get your view on this? One, she mentioned 17P and high-risk patients, Craig, and I'm curious, this question of BTK, this broad question of BTK versus venetoclax CD20, how you think through higher-risk patients.
I don't stop patients on ibrutinib if they're responding to it, but I have not started a patient on ibrutinib since acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib have been available. As far as patients with either P53 mutated or 17p abnormality, routinely, I mean, historically, I've been giving obinutuzumab and venetoclax, and if the patients are MRD negative, keeping the patients on venetoclax, and then when they start to progress, then I'll start a BTK inhibitor. But in the back of my mind, and as was in the presentation, the issue of CAR T cells, which the data is not overly clear on whether it should be used in patients that are P53 positive, I'm still a fan of in patients who are relapsing after initial therapy with P53 mutated disease, if they're young enough. I know this is going to sound terrible, but I will still refer patients for a non-ablative allotransplant.
So, Danielle, I'm curious also how you think through the high-risk situation. But another thing I'm starting to hear from people is this question of whether or not to add a CD20 onto BTK, particularly acalabrutinib, where we saw there was a little bit of a bump when you added obinutuzumab. I'm curious how you approach now. Of course, you're bringing in the issue of IV therapy, but I am curious whether or not you add anti-CD20 onto BTK. I hear people talking about, for example, younger patients where they're not worried about cardiac risk. Any thoughts about that, Danielle?
Yes, definitely. So in the frontline setting, just saying it, but I think this is especially where we need clinical trial combinations that would knock down the TP53 or the 17P clone. But outside of eligibility for that, which right now in frontline trials is sometimes an issue, I tend to favor BTK inhibitor over ven, obinutuzumab fixed duration. One, in the frontline setting, you don't know till they reach the end of that year if they're going to get a deep remission. We know from longer follow-up that those are the patients that have a shorter PFS and less undetectable. So I tend to favor a BTK, although if combinations are approved, I think that'll be an interesting population to look at. In terms of adding anti-CD20, what you're certainly getting to is, you know, in the first trial, the cooperative group study that looked at adding anti-CD20 rituximab in the frontline setting versus bendamustine for older patients, the ibrutinib rituximab was no different than ibrutinib alone. But we've now had other studies, not just with BTK inhibitors, showing obinutuzumab as more benefit than rituximab for patients. So I think it certainly deserved to be revisited. And when the frontline study of acala versus acala obin versus chemo initially came out, the story was combining, looking at the acala regimens. But as you're stating, now that we see longer follow-up, those curves are potentially starting to separate in terms of PFS and response. I think the bottom line is for high-risk patients, it's going to take a long time to look at things like overall survival, but if we get a deeper remission up front for those high-risk patients or a deeper response, I think that's what they deserve to have.
So, Craig, a lot of times in oncology, we're kind of stuck with indirect comparison. And one a question a lot of people have is acalabrutinib, which a lot of people, as you were just mentioning, too, have switched over to in recent years, versus zanubrutinib, where, as I mentioned, we saw even more data at the ASH meeting. Again, we're kind of stuck with indirect comparisons, but it is interesting that zanubrutinib, you know, is reporting an advantage in terms of efficacy, although it's kind of controversial in terms of the data itself and how the trial was done. I'm curious indirectly how you compare both efficacy and tolerability of zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib, Craig.
So first, I would say that as somebody who also takes medicines, not cancer medicines, anytime I can take a pill once a day versus twice a day, that's going to be a winner. Acalabrutinib still has some headaches. Still, there is some efficacy issues as far as taking it twice a day. I guess, once again, I don't give it much anymore. There was issues with taking it with proton pump inhibitors. They changed the formulation. That has now been adjusted.
Danielle, any thoughts again about selecting a BTK inhibitor and your experiences in terms of tolerability of the available BTK inhibitors?
Sure. I think certainly, as was said, I haven't newly started anyone on ibrutinib, though I have many patients remaining on it. But between acala and zanubrutinib, until very, very recently, we had many, many patients going on acalabrutinib for CLL. And as a frontline option, I think have done, you know, fairly well. And the trials with CLL, at least for zanubrutinib, I'd be curious how it plays out, or twice a day. But certainly, I think this is where it's interesting, these drugs that are used across lymphomas, because we start to gain experience, not just in one disease type. But the two trials that randomized head-to-head versus ibrutinib, the acala trial versus ibrutinib and the zanu versus ibrutinib were different patient populations. They, of course, both were relapse refractory, but the acala required patients be high risk 11Q or 17P. So I do caution from an efficacy difference in comparing those trials, just because that though they were both relapse refractory, we know those higher risk markers make that trial different. And it also started, you know, earlier chronologically, so it was a different group of patients going on those. I think in the end, it's the bottom line, just good to have more than one option. As I pointed out, you know, these discussions are obviously very important for patients. I think there are other very important things like the timing of you know, once versus twice a day, or certainly of cost, because these agents are given continuously and hopefully in the frontline setting for many years.
So, Craig, a couple of questions we get all the time. I see a couple of people in the chat room are bringing this up, but related to venetoclax in the first-line setting. The trial stopped therapy after a year, but also looked at MRD. And I'm curious whether you look at MRD in patients who are completing their year of venetoclax, and if the MRD is positive, would you consider continuing therapy? The other question I have for you is how you integrate anti-CD20 when you're using venetoclax in the Murano regimen. They're given together. A lot of people like to debulk the patient with CD20 first and then give the venetoclax. So two questions about venetoclax. One, what do you do if they're MRD positive? And two, in the relapse setting, how do you sequence CD20?
I always start with obinutuzumab first, induction. If you do that, obviously there's almost no tumor lysis. You certainly don't need to admit the patient. There's some mild chemical abnormalities, but everybody here in the room can deal with that. So, I mean, that's just a common sense approach. Once again, I don't see as much CLL as I used to because I focus on other lymphomas. But I think if the patient is, so in patients who I give venetoclax and obinutuzumab too, which are pretty much always patients who have unfavorable risk factors, if they're still positive at the end, invariably I will switch to a BTK inhibitor if they're MRD positive. If they're MRD negative, then the question becomes, they certainly don't need any more obinutuzumab. And if they have bad cytogenetics, I think that, you know, they're a time bomb. So once again, I just, with no data behind it, I just continue the venetoclax.
So maybe we'll come back to questions about CLL later. We're going to let Danielle talk a little bit about follicular and mantle cell. But before you do, one other question about CLL, Danielle. You know, one of the things we like to do is just ask people, what would you like to do? How would you like to treat pay? Just put reimbursement aside. And one of the things I'm seeing when we ask that question, particularly when we present a patient with unmutated disease, Danielle, is more and more people saying, I'd like to give BTK and venetoclax together. Are there situations right now where you'd like to do that, Danielle?
Cost and approval aside, because it's not yet approved, yes, I think very much. You mentioned unmutated IGHV, and that's about 60% of patients starting on therapy. So it's not just, to your point, the highest risk markers. And those patients we saw are less likely at the end of 1 year of venetoclax to have that deep remission. But I think beyond that, a younger, fit patient, again, our goal for these patients is not just, you know, their first couple years of PFS, but really being able to sequence them for many years. And I think many of us think for the right patient, the combination is fixed duration, you're less likely to get resistance, and you probably can reuse some of those agents in combination. For older patients or patients medically complicated medical problems, I think we have to think carefully, because the last thing we want to do is try to give more and actually end up stopping therapy or incompletely being able to give treatment and patients ending up with less response than they would have with monotherapy.
One more additional question again before you get to follicular, Danielle. We were talking about pirtobrutinib, and yes, it's been approved in mantle cell, not yet in CLL. But I'm curious, outside a trial setting right now, what your favorite approach would be to a patient who's progressed on BTK and then progresses on venetoclax anti-CD20?
That's a very difficult situation if both are progressed. I think the non-covalent, including pirtobrutinib in clinical trials, have been very promising for patients that need disease control. I would say that would be my favorite. We talked a little bit about CAR-T. I still also, for patients, think about cellular therapy. But for both those things, CAR-T and traditional allo, patients' disease needs to be in a good response. You can overcome high-risk markers, but you can't overcome rapidly progressive bulky disease. So pirtobrutinib or other BTK, if patients can get a response, it probably also helps their CAR-T, as we're seeing, but disease control is obviously very important.
I'm curious in whether bispecifics are ever going to come to CLL, which brings us to follicular and mantle cell. So maybe you could review that a little bit, Danielle.
Of course. How do you approach therapy for patients with relapsed follicular? Where do lenalidomide, copanlisib, tazemetostat, and CAR-T, as well as most of the bispecific we talked about, fit in? Again, for the purposes of time, just outlining, I think for patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, as many in this room know, that patients can present very differently with follicular. Some don't require therapy, and many can go years after treatment. However, I do just want to highlight, it's important to frame the conversation about how to treat patients by recognizing those we know are high risk. So some of those features we don't test as much, say in follicular for TP53, for example, but it is recognized patients with early relapse, especially in that 2 years or POD 24 months, have much inferior outcomes. And I think how to approach those therapies, say versus a patient that got rituximab, went a number of years and now has other chemotherapy options, is really important. The second point, I think, not just for follicular, we mentioned it with CLL, is that indolent lymphomas can transform. For follicular, it's a little less than 5% per year, about 5% of all CLL patients. So just remembering, if patients are relapse or progressing quickly, distinguishing this from true follicular lymphoma, especially in the earlier, more rapid setting, because you would approach that treatment differently. And in terms of other options when they relapse, as I mentioned, it depends the extent of disease, the reason for their symptoms. outcomes, as well as how quickly that they relapse. For some patients, chemoimmunotherapy is still a good option. However, in the relapse refractory setting, we've now seen a number of other agents, lenalidomide and anti-CD20, both as frontline and in first relapse for patients, can be very effective compared to chemoimmunotherapy, and many can continue on that option. For patients, though, in their third relapse or this early relapse, I think thinking about other targeted agents rather than chemo increasingly important. So about a quarter of patients will have this EZH2 mutation, and we recently saw data for patients getting treatment with tazemetostat, and patients had a median response of about a year for the patients with mutation, even those without. PI3 kinase inhibitors for follicular lymphoma, we've seen over the last year or so shrink in available agents, as many know, largely because of concerns about toxicity. But copanalisib still being an option. And now for follicular and finding the right patient, perhaps, but also the availability of CAR-T, both for those that transform, but also follicular lymphoma and multiple relapses. The question here, though, of course, is why or how do we make that age or that type of therapy more active for patients, because for many patients it is not. And then the second part, when administering a BTK inhibitor to a patient with mantle cell lymphoma, which do we prefer, and are there situations to utilize it in the frontline setting? And then also we'll talk about multi-regimen relapse mantle cell lymphoma, and where do some of these other agents, such as venetoclax, we've talked a bit about pirtobrutinib already, and CAR-T fit in. For mantle cell lymphoma, for those that have helped treat patients with this, of course, you know, it also can be very heterogeneous in presentation. There's a very small subset that doesn't require therapy. Then there's the group of patients we know up front, unfortunately, have inferior outcomes, especially to chemo. Those are with TP53 aberrations, and those with this so-called blastoid-type presentation. And so in the relapse setting, again, it depends how patients first present and how quickly they relapse. But remember, for mantle cell lymphoma versus follicular, we just talked about, many of these patients that were eligible for intensive chemo already got chemo and potentially auto and potentially maintenance rituximab. So particularly in that relapse setting, I think switching to more novel targeted agents, and now for patients that have had a BTK inhibitor and chemotherapy, having the option of CAR-T. For CAR-T in that group of patient population, the response rate was pretty high and CRs were over 50%. But we just have to remember, and for those that help care for these patients, that in trials, of course, that time period to get to CAR-T, especially for a disease like mantle cell that can be rapidly progressive, means that patients in real clinical practice, you may not be able to bridge and get from the time of collection to treatment. So I think it's an important novel therapeutic approach, but how we get patients there and optimize that is really important part of it. I won't go in as much as the BTK inhibitors because we talked about this in CLL, but I think for myself and others here, it's a kind of a similar story in terms of second generation covalent BTK inhibitors because of the safety profile, and then for those with resistance now having available pirtobrutinib. In terms of the frontline setting, though, just remembering the TP53 aberrated or unlikely to respond to chemo, but unless the patient was older or unfit, I think the goal of frontline therapy still for most patients is trying to get them to a place to consolidate.
So I'm going to be real curious to see what Craig has to say about bispecifics in general lymphoma, and particularly in follicular lymphoma, as you just reviewed, now that we have mosunetuzumab. But first, Suzanne, let me go back to you and see any questions in the room.
So I actually am going to jump in with a question. So I agree that you bring up the comment of consolidation. So I think it brings up a really interesting question in mantle cell, whether or not we need to consolidate with transplant or not. I personally don't think that answer is clear as of yet, but I was interested in both of your thoughts on that.
Sure. So For someone who's made a career on transplanting lymphoma and wrote Ice and Rice, you would think that I'd be transplant friendly. In reality, you know, at the plenary session, whether it should have been at the plenary session or not is debatable, but at the plenary session, the randomized study, which used RSC-based induction followed by consolidation, showed that transplant did not improve progression-free survival if you use that particular regimen. So that's one thing to keep in mind. I think that it is really tough to beat bendamustine and rituximab in mantle cell lymphoma. I don't think it was beaten in the randomized study that was published in New England Journal with BR plus or minus ibrutinib, and it's incredibly difficult to come up with something that's superior to that, especially in a patient population which is basically old men. That's who we're taking care of, men who are 65 to 75. So I think the era of auto transplant is over, especially in the era of CAR T cells. You can give CAR T cells in the relapse setting. I could talk about this all day, but in general, for the audience, if you do not do a lot of CAR T cell therapy, it is more toxic in mantle cell lymphoma than it is in large cell lymphoma. It's a slightly different drug. Than in the large cell lymphoma drug, and it's definitely more toxic, so you've got to be careful, and the people are older. Be that as it may, you know, patients can have a very long remission duration in the relapse setting with CAR T cells, which is very unlikely with an auto transplant. So for what it's worth, I think it's kind of dying. Sorry for that long-winded thing. But, you know, 20 years worth of research, and now we're back to not doing transplant.
Just as long as we picked up on the mantle cell theme, just kind of curious, Danielle, where do you envision you bringing in pirtobrutinib at this point, and where, particularly as it relates to CAR-T, before or after?
Well, as I mentioned a little bit, I think with CLL is that I think, though, for any lymphoma, it holds true, which is being able to get disease control before cellular therapies such as CAR-T, for example, having cared for some inpatients too, trying to get to CAR-T, that bridging time period can be very, very difficult. So sometimes I guess my point would be to have the luxury of using it after might be nice right now because of the timing of approval of these agents. But personally, I think especially for patients with bulky disease, it might help to gain disease control as more and more patients, again, this is a moving target, right? Our first studies with BTK or CAR-T, those patients had chemotherapy and auto and rituximab before they relapse. Now more and more patients are going to have other inhibitors sooner, and having BTK inhibitor resistance and still being able to respond to pirtobrutinib or other non-covalent BTK inhibitors, I think will move that sooner. For mantle cell and CLL, I think one of the questions is going to be what, though, does the resistance pattern look like to these different BTK inhibitors? A lot of what we learned was from ibrutinib and some that have boldly looked at the other BTK inhibitors, but quite frankly, I think it's still early to know for these non-covalent what happens if resistance to those develop. How does that change your sequence of other therapies?
So, Craig, getting back to follicular lymphoma, and you're going to be talking about bispecifics and diffuse large B-cell. I'm curious how you think that's going to play out, particularly in terms of who's going to actually be using these bispecifics. But let's just start with follicular to start with, Craig. We already had a whole bunch of options in the relapse setting, both in patients who might have been eligible theoretically for CAR-T or not. Now you have mosunetuzumab coming in there. Where do you see that fitting in? Who do you see giving mosunetuzumab? What are some of the caveats about tolerability with bispecifics and specifically mosunetuzumab?
So the point was very well taken. Remembering that when patients relapse, if the remission duration is short and if the PET scan is significantly abnormal, more than half the patients have large cell lymphoma. That's why POD24 is impossible to study. It can't be studied in the cooperative group setting. There's been a number of negative studies. So I don't know where that's going, but in patients that relapse, I really don't understand why anybody would not give a bispecific prior to CAR T cells, as opposed to waiting for CAR T cells not to work and then giving a bispecific after. It's more of an issue with large cell lymphoma. Mosunetuzumab is a simple drug to give. First of all, it's sub-Q. CRS is really non-existent. We've been studying it now for almost 3 years, combining it with or without polatuzumab, and in large cell lymphoma, it's simple. It was a big to-do in the beginning, admitting these patients and watching for tumor lysis, but since it's gone to the sub-Q formulation, it's really benign. So for me, in patients who need to be treated in the relapse setting, the question would be, are you going to give R-squared or are you going to give mosunetuzumab? And that's a lot of that is going to be based upon you all, what you're more comfortable with. But I think that's where the competition will be. And you always have to think ahead. Will mosunetuzumab salve in an R-square failure? Maybe, maybe not. And vice versa. How is R-squared after mosunetuzumab? But I think both of those treatments are going to be given before CAR T-cells. I don't see any reason. CAR T-cells, in my book, there's no evidence that it works better earlier as opposed to working later. Everybody gets that? So in large cell lymphoma, the data is very, very similar for patients in fourth relapse as it is in second relapse. There's only a few percentage points different. And we got all these drugs. I'll discuss it in a minute in large cell lymphoma. But definitely, once bispecifics are going to be available to you and you're comfortable with it, you're going to give it before CAR T-cells.
So, Danielle, before Craig brings up the issue of diffuse large B-cell and all the things that are going on there, any other thoughts about sequencing of the multiple options available with follicular? Any experience with tazemetostat? How do you using that? Does it matter whether they have the EZH2 mutation? Again, any thoughts about sequencing all these options?
Great point. I think for many patients with follicular that haven't, of course, transformed or relapsed early, however we distinguish that, I think the options are really going to be about patient goals and tolerability, because many patients can live a long time versus, for example, you know, trying to think of the right sequence so that one leads way to better responses than the other. For the EZH2 mutation question, there are increased responses, although with the mutation for the drug. However, the duration of the response, at least for the patients that were studied, was around about the same, which was about 1 year. These patients studied in trials are not necessarily now the patients that might be eligible for the drug, particularly if they've had a lot of prior therapy. So I personally, amongst my group of team of lymphoma, have not had a lot of use of it, but I think it's still early, and for the right patient and from like a toxicity and tolerability and what other options they have, I think still something to keep in mind. In terms of the bispecifics, I agree, though, that I think as people become comfortable with the use of them, as they're not just IV but subcutaneous, I think that's going to give a lot more options for patients and for something that's not a continuous type therapy until they progress.
I think the difference in follicular as well is that we don't have as much of a rush for the bridging question with CAR T. There are definitely situations where there is a little bit more of a urgency, but compared to diffuse large, or even myeloma, we have a bit more time to wait for the manufacture of the product in follicular compared to other disease subsets.
And it'll be very, I think, interesting for the CAR T question, for CLL, for example, or other diseases where it's a long time and your T cells are so dysfunctional, if the timing of the CAR T does matter for that versus large cell lymphoma, for example.
Just if you're interested in this issue of blood advances, there is a large series on bridging therapy prior to CAR T cells with the Novartis product. There it does help, because that's the worst of the three products. So if you bridge and if you achieve a CR, the results are really quite good. But if you achieve just a PR, the results are not so great. So with that particular product, it really makes sense to bridge.
All right, why don't we move on to diffuse large B-cell, and Craig, you can review your chalk talks.
Okay. So the question was, for patients with relapsed and refractory disease, how do I sequence CAR T-cells, polatuzumab, taflen, and Lancastuximab, tesirine, and selinexor? Well, first, I've been at the FDA many times. I've gotten a few drugs approved. If I was at the FDA, I wouldn't have approved this drug. The CR rate is so low, and the only thing that's important in large cell lymphoma is a complete response, because everybody in the room knows partial responders just progress at the next restaging, right? So you need to achieve a CR. So, and here we are looking at CR rates that are similar to prednisone. So I don't give this drug. Now, polatuzumab, vedotin, and BR, which is what was approved for relapsed and refractory large cell lymphoma, also nobody gives. Everybody gives polatuzumab and rituximab alone, probably because bendamustine is not an overly active drug in large cell lymphoma. And in fact, I don't know anybody who gives BR and polo. They give just the doublet. And this can be fairly good palliative treatment. The problem is neuropathy, which does happen. And the CR rate with this drug is give or take around 30%. And that's the critical aspect, because about half of the CR patients have not relapsed. And that's a theme I'll try to tell this story with all these drugs. If you achieve a CR, what do you do? Okay, we know what we do if the patient does not achieve a CR. But if a CR happens, you have to make you have a treatment decision to make. Now, another one of my least favorite programs, but this was a program called tafasitamab and lenalidomide. One of the reasons that I don't like it is because the patients are always there. They have to come like 12 weeks in a row. You tend to give this to elderly patients, and they get tired of this. But this was the most highly selective treatment program in the history of relapsed and refractory large cell lymphoma. It's almost impossible to get enrolled in this study. So it actually looks like it looks pretty good. It's also continuous treatment. You know, you get the drugs until progression. But in reality, at ASH, this is the real-world experience of tafasitamab and lenalidomide, and the results are not good. The median PFS is right at the time of the restaging, or even prior to the restaging. So remember, it's 12 weeks of tafasitamab and lenalidomide, and on the research study, that's when you did a scan. Here you can see that the median PFS is 2.1 months, so half the patients were relapsing even before they were supposed to be imaged. So this is problematic for this program, especially in the era of new drugs. This is an oral presentation we had at ASH looking at pretreatment metabolic tumor volume. So we got all of the PET scans on the patients in the registration trial of loncastuximab tesirine in the LOTIS-2 trial, 180 patients with large cell lymphoma. We were able to show that patients who had a low to moderate low metabolic tumor volume, there's a tail on the curve. We're also able to predict which patients were able to have a CR. It's another program that has about a 30 to 33% CR rate, and the CRs can be durable. And then lastly, we have the CAR T cells. So we happen to be an axi-cell center. I don't know about Duke, but this is what we tend to give. The lysocell is just impossible to get. There's manufacturing problems with it. Even though it can be given as an outpatient, it's really tough, and there's like a waiting list to get it. So if you have to wait to get your large cell lymphoma treatment, you'll probably be dead. So that's not going to work. And the middle drug is the least efficacious. So most people, right now give the Kite product. And in the random assignment trials comparing CAR T cells versus auto transplant. Once again, whether I like the studies or not, the results are in favor of the auto transplant arm, in the CAR T cell arms in two of the three programs. The Belinda study actually had a worse patient population than the other two programs, but survival has not been shown as of yet, as of ASH. My gut feeling is there's going to be a survival advantage compared to auto transplant if we wait a little bit longer. If that does happen, then quite frankly, auto transplant in first relapse is really going to be dead. Because everybody knows that once there's an overall survival advantage, you probably have to change therapy because it almost never happens in lymphoma. So based upon the data, the available data, what do I think we're going to be doing with bispecifics in relapsed and refractory disease? So I love the bispecifics, as you probably could tell. Epcoritamab and glofitamab don't need to be respected. These drugs definitely can cause CRS. Some of the formulations are trying to be changed to sub-Q formulations, but over 40% of the patients are in CR, and almost three quarters of the CR patients are still in CR at 18 to 24 months. So that's what you have to kind of think in the back of your head. So if I give either one of these drugs and the CR happens, and the CRs always happen early, the first time you look, it almost never happens the second time you look, and PRs almost never convert to CRs. So if you achieve a CR with these drugs, and you maintain the drug however long you're supposed to maintain it, in the research study that you're on, and then you stop, and if the patients are in CR, I mean, you might have cured the patient. So you have to keep that in mind. There are a gazillion bispecifics that are coming along. Mosunetuzumab is not a large cell lymphoma drug by itself. Whether it's going to be working when combined with other things, because it's the least potent and can be combined with some friends, so it may be more, that may help the efficacy. Glofitamab is so strong, you have to start with obinutuzumab to debulk a little bit, and then you give glofitamab. So I love these drugs. Heavily involved, so I can't really talk much more about it, but I do think they will both get approved, and I do think you're all going to be using them. Epcoritamab may be a little bit easier to tolerate than glofitamab. This is the waterfall plot with mosunetuzumab, and you can see it's okay, but look, the CR rate is only 19.4%, kind of low. And as I said, PRs progress. And here are the CR rates with glofitamab, and you can see it's 39.4%. And magically, it's almost the same with epcoritamab. It's also about 40%. So they're both kind of confusing with their industry partners being in the United States and in Europe, and how the clinical trials are being done, and who owns what, and what can you study. But be that as it may, these drugs are going to get fast-tracked at the FDA, and you're going to have them. So we all have to learn how to use them. And here are the press releases for epcoritamab, as well as for glofitamab. So these drugs are coming, and you can just imagine, just like with the more than the BTK inhibitors, all of our pharmaceutical friends have got their own bispecific. Whether they're potent or not, whether they're better or not, but you'll see a lot of combinations with new drugs that are available.
So, Craig, just to follow up before you get into Hodgkin lymphoma, any follow-up to the POLARIX study in diffuse large B-cell that was first presented a year ago at the ASH meeting, substituting polatuzumab for vincristine and R-CHOP? You expect that to be approved? If it does become approved, or even now, are there situations where you prefer it?
Yeah, so it's so funny. It's approved in England, and it's not approved there, here, and they can't get anything in Great Britain. I think that the program is, there's no difference in overall survival between the two groups. It is extremely clear to me that the Archipola only works in the ABC subtype. It's absolutely no different in the GCB subtype or in double hit large cell lymphoma. If, as Neil asked the question before, if I could do whatever I wanted to do, I would give Archipola in the ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma. And when it's approved, I will certainly do that. No problem doing it at all. I don't know what's taking so long, obviously, they're scrutinizing the data.
Danielle, anything you want to add to that in terms of upfront treatment of diffuse large B-cell? Also, the question of using CAR-T in diffuse large B-cell in older patients. There was a study looking at transplant-ineligible patients looking at CAR-T and liso-cel, and those patients did really well. Any thoughts about upfront treatment and particularly the Polarix approach? But also, again, the use of CAR-T.
Sure. I don't think I have anything else articulate to add after that discussion for the front line. But I think your point about CAR-T, and Greg brought this up earlier, for patients that are older or less fit, is really important. Perhaps as we all learn how better to give CAR-T and it being available outpatient, and also realizing not every product obviously is the same, that for patients not having transplant, CAR-T certainly can help fill a void there. However, I think we have seen with mantle cell lymphoma, or as CAR-T is approved across disease types and the patients in our clinic are receiving it, that certainly managing patients through that with advanced age is at least in my experience, very, very different process. So I think it's really important to keep in mind, though, maybe still better than putting our patients through allo transplant. It still can be a very difficult process, particularly if patients are at high risk of, for example, neurotoxicity. And I think we have to think carefully about selecting patients for that.
So before we go to Suzanne for a question from the audience, Craig, it wouldn't be a program of diffuse large B-cell unless somebody, as several people have in the chat room, brought up the issue of dose-adjusted EPOC and double and triple hit lymphoma, but also the question of CNS prophylaxis.
Okay, I'll do it. So I give dose-adjusted EPOC only for PMBL and I do use it for double and triple hit large cell lymphoma. Even though the data sets are small, I do think it's reasonable to do that. CNS prophylaxis is, once again, a quagmire. In patients, remember, in the rituximab era, patients relapsed parenchymally. They almost rarely relapse in the fluid. So what I do is, if I think somebody with a breast large cell lymphoma or testicular large cell lymphoma, or patients who have very, very high risk disease based upon the CNS IPI, I give high-dose methotrexate at the end. I give one dose, and if they're okay, then I'll do another dose. If not, that's all I do. I do not give intrathecal therapy. Obviously, in patients with disease in the fluid, I put an Ommeyer in, I give both intrathecal and intravenous methotrexate. And I give Mr. R-CHOP in that setting, which also is a difficult program. I think that's the easiest thing to do, and that's how I practice. Other people practice differently. But I think the era of just giving 4 to 6 cycles of intrathecal methotrexate, I feel like that's only treating the physician. I don't know what that's doing to the patient.
Suzanne, you had a question?
Yep, absolutely. So I think it's not possible to have a CAR-T discussion without bringing up cost. And so as we debate CAR-T versus auto, I think it's obvious that auto transplant is in the range of 50 $55,000 at this point in time, compared to CAR T, which, you know, now Lysocell is over $400,000 in 2023. And so I think it will be interesting to see what kind of insurance pushback there is there with regard to making those decisions when they are comparable options. They are not always. So that was more of a commentary, so I apologize. But I did want to bring that up. The other is, I think we're going to have to ask the question in terms of bites in diffuse large B-cell, whether or not, how we're going to sequence those when one becomes available compared to CAR-T, where we're going to use the bites. Are we going to use it before CAR-T? Are we going to use it after? So I think that, those are interesting questions that are definitely going to be coming our way. We do have a question from the audience, which is, what is the relapse rate post-CAR-T?
Well, I think the issue is, you know how CAR-T cell studies were done. You got to scan at 1 month. If you were in CR at 1 month, and if you were in CR at 6 months, and if you at 90 days, and at CR at a year, two-thirds of those patients have not relapsed. So, just do the math. A lot of people relapse. If you relapse early, the patient's going to die from large cell lymphoma. If you relapse between the 3 month and the 1 year point, this is the area where there's a tremendous amount of industry partners that are looking at drugs to give. All the drugs that we said, that we already discussed already, are being used in that setting. And early relapses are a big trouble coming.
And then there is still a question asking about how much COVID remains a factor with anti-CD20 therapies in 2023.
I just ignore it. It's a non-issue for me.
Yeah, I think because it's, you know, not a problem going away, and, you know, uncontrolled bad lymphoma equally, we've seen patients have unfortunate outcomes, not just COVID, but historically too with flu. I think that part we've moved on for. I think maybe the one place that people are going back to ask the question is maybe with indolent lymphomas, of giving like 3 years of, not mantle cell, I'm talking where survival benefit, but say follicular or other places where maybe you gave 3 years of maintenance rituximab, is that really kind of, you know, necessary, not just from COVID, but kind of in general, if you're not making an overall survival difference? But otherwise, I think we've just had to kind of move on because of the impact the bad lymphoma can have for infectious outcomes.
Why don't we move on now and talk about Hodgkin? Craig, you put together a couple of chalk talks on that.
Sure. My favorite disease, as you know. How do you approach first-line treatment for advanced-stage disease? So how do you guys treat advanced-stage Hodgkin lymphoma? Do you give ABVD? Do you give escalated Biakov times 4 or 6? Do you give BVAVD? Do you give? Do you do PET-adapted therapy starting with ABVD, or do you do PET-adapted therapy starting with escalated Biakov? And remember, advanced-stage disease is stage 3 or 4. Many studies also had stage 2 patients in it, from what I remember, but I'm getting old. That's not advanced-stage Hodgkin lymphoma. So, you know, BVAVD falls somewhere in the middle between ABVD and escalated Biakov, and probably, quite frankly, we won't discuss this today, but Nivo-AVD or Pembro-AVD probably fall probably somewhere between ABVD and BVAVD, a little bit closer to BVAVD than to ABVD. I think that this is at this particular point, this is moot. BVAVD shows a survival advantage to ABVD. This had a very storied debates in the Hodgkin lymphoma community of whether you should give BVAVD or not, because it wasn't compared to PET-adapted therapy and all that. But the bottom line is, now there's an overall survival advantage to BVAVD, so should give it. The waterfall plot, everything seems to be in favor of getting BVAVD. In patients with stage 3 disease with no risk factors, probably those patients don't necessarily need BVAVD, but that's really splitting hairs. And if you want to just be comfortable, if you're not a lymphoma doc, I would just give BVAVD for stage 3 or 4 disease. How do I treat advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma? I did enroll the patient on the patients on the national study. We're one of the leading accruers. That study's closed. 1,000 patients, Nivo-AVD versus BVAVD. Off protocol, I give BV-AVD for stage 3B and stage 4 patients. I do PET adaptive therapy for stage 3A because of, you know, the water, because of the forest plot. Bulky stage 2 disease, once again, is not advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma. Typically, patients got 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy and radiation. There is some evidence you may not need to radiate from the Italians based upon, you know, robust PET imaging. And the next study, intergroup study, which will not be phase 3, will be phase 2. It will include novel agents. Now, camilumimab, now this one I have been involved with quite a bit. I'm a friend of some of these people. And will this drug get FDA approved based upon the evidence? So the answer is this drug's never getting approved by the FDA, and Craig has never given this drug. I was involved in research studies with this. I've seen some quite interesting things. And I know people, I know every one of these patients with who have had neurologic toxicity. I know all of their doctors. I know all the patients who have had Guillain-Barré syndrome. And it's done. This drug is not getting approved. And I think that ADC Therapeutics is very likely going to stop development. You know, sometimes drugs are good. Now, I think Neil will remember, but when I was training, there was a drug called gallium nitrate. I was like a kid. And it was like a really good drug. But, you know, people were getting blind. So obviously the drug didn't get approved. So, I mean, the last thing we're going to be doing is giving a patient Guillain-Barré. So it's not going anywhere. Happy to answer questions if you guys might have them.
Any thoughts about where you see first-line therapy for extensive, say, Hodgkin's landing in the next couple years?
Yeah, so I think that the way the study was written was very similar to the relevance study, where BR was compared to R-squared, which was a study where R-squared had to be shown to be superior. So this study, Nivo-AVD, is in the statistics, has to be almost 6% better. In the United States, with growth factor support, BV-AVD is about 83 to 84% at 5 years. So that means we're asking Nivo-AVD, at the primary endpoints are at 2 years, to be at 90% progression-free survival at 2 years. I think that that's a leap of faith. What happens if the drug treatment programs are equivalent and Nivo-AVD is much less toxic? That'll be up to the FDA. I personally think, and I've given patients both of these treatments, we put like 24 patients on this study. I actually think that the Nivo-AVD treatment is, it's easy on the blood counts, but there's a litany of complaints that the patients have, from rash to difficulty swallowing to you name it, but they don't get neuropathy. So if there's going to be a lot of grade 3 neuropathy in this national study and the treatment programs are equivalent, I can imagine petitioning the FDA as this being a program, but we'll have to wait and see. I think 90% is an unbelievably high bar. I mean, that's like better than early stage Hodgkin lymphoma.
Yeah, and Kevi in the chat room asked the same question I just have, is why aren't they looking at BVADD with a nivolumab? Why aren't they looking at that? It seems like that might be maybe.
So the next national study will have, it has Nivo, BV, A, and D. And I think that will be a randomized phase 2 that's making its way through committees. But that's an early stage disease. The advanced stage one, I don't know where that's going. But I will tell you though that the German program, which substitutes, adds brentuximab to Beacop and takes out procarbazine and adds dacarbazine and takes out Blio at the Cologne meetings. I mean, I know this is really gonna be hard to believe, but it's at 99% at like 2 years. I mean, it's like, we looked at this presentation, our mouth was open. So more to come. I mean, I think that there's a lot of things to do. I don't think we need to have a program that causes 99% of the patients do well. That means we're over-treating patients, right? Everybody would agree. So we have to start taking things away. So happy to chat with this with you over email about that. But that data is coming.
So Suzanne, do you want to close us out here?
Absolutely. Thank you to both of our speakers, Dr. Moskowitz and Dr. Brander. And upcoming is gynecologic malignancies.
Well, thanks for having me.